tonight. I thought maybe start a little series of talks on some of the family stories of Zen. Like all families, we have our stories. And one of the unique features of the Zen school is somehow they came up with the idea that the Buddha's teachings on awakening and the end of suffering could be expressed through brief stories. Stories usually of some kind of meeting or some kind of contact, some kind of encounter. Sometimes an encounter between like a Zen master, so-called, and a student. But stories, which was kind of a new twist in the Buddhist tradition, to put so much faith and so much weight in stories, often stories that are quite short. And somehow out of this, we have practices as well that were informed by these stories of meeting or touching something. So like our practice of 1 to 7 days of sitting and walking and chanting together like one body called Seishin. That word Seishin means touching the heart, touching the mind. So contact, meeting the heart, meeting the mind. So we say meditation retreat, but that's not really what it is, actually. It's not really a meditation retreat. And somehow just in the act of meeting or making contact or being with something, right there in that meeting, in that moment of meeting, is what we need. And that there's nothing outside of that. So these stories of meaning and meeting, of course, became the famous Zen koan literature, which I know some of us have studied with John and with other people and other places, but I think it would be useful to bring up a selection of the koans, partly just to understand a little more about our tradition and some of the archetypal and apocryphal and colorful and sometimes bizarre stories that inform the style of practice. Because in earlier Buddhism and in other schools of Buddhism, they don't write these down. The story, you know, encounters between teachers and students are private or just as a matter of course or not even emphasized. We're very used to, in our school, a strong emphasis on private meetings with the teacher, but other schools don't emphasize that so much. Some other schools of Buddhism emphasize study, like a class, lots and lots of classes. Other schools emphasize preliminary practices. Like before you would do meditation, you would do a preliminary practice, like 100,000 prostrations is a common preliminary practice. So you'd probably be pretty steady in your Zendo attendance if you had to do 100,000 prostrations before you were allowed to come. So we emphasize these encounters, these stories, these private and public meetings as a way of understanding how we're meeting our life. And so in Zen, they started writing down collections of, you know, the story of a master wouldn't be exactly like a sort of scholarly story of the finer points of their teaching. It would be a collection of stories. So they started collecting these stories about different masters, different teachers in China, starting in somewhere around the 6th or 7th century. And over the years, these stories were retold in talks just like this one, probably, and collected and codified and like polished up until about the 11th century when they were written down in organized collections of stories, of koans. And so the stories became sort of official and standardized. And another great aspect of the Zen school is we have, and this is true, I suppose, of all Buddhism in a way, there's a willingness to sort of hold opposites together, hold opposite ideas together. So on the one hand, Zen has the idea of spontaneity, right? Iconoclastic, bizarre, surprising behavior from Zen teachers. And yet, Zen school also has incredibly thoroughgoing orthodoxy and consistency and official ways to do things and say things. So these stories are like sort of orthodox versions of spontaneity in some way. Which is, in a way, bothersome and in a way really helpful to us, because that's part of where we're tripped up, right? We always want something to be this or that, right? This is really characteristic of American culture around emotion, I think. Like, happiness should be spontaneous, for instance. And if you're happy, you're not sad. If you're sad, you're not happy. And so I think Buddhism suggests that it's a little more nuanced than that. You can train in happiness. You can be sad and happy at the same time. These stories have that quality too, I think, of either and, not either or. So there are the three most famous collections of these Zen stories are called The Blue Cliff Record, The Gateless Gate, and The Book of Serenity. So tonight I'd like to speak on the first case from The Blue Cliff Record. And it's hard to really know how important the order is, but it seems likely that that the first one, just like in our culture, has a certain pride of place and is especially important. And I got into doing this because, sort of like out of desperation, about a month ago, I had to come up with a talk really quick. I tell you about my adventure in Massachusetts a couple of weeks ago, yeah. So I just grabbed my favorite Zen story and gave me a little talk about it really quickly there. And it went well. And then I gave the talk again here. And what I noticed was that different points came out in the talk. I don't know if it was you guys, the audience, or the situation, the meeting, or something different occurred to me, but a little bit different points came out. And then last Sunday, I gave that talk a third time in Seattle. So it's a well-shopped talk. And so, but in the course of doing that, I was just sort of impressed anew by the sort of depth and potential of these stories. It's so easy when you read them to make certain assumptions based on your habitual view. And it's not all sort of spelled out, right? It's not really explained. There's a lot of room to read things in or let things come out or both. So I thought it would be worthwhile for us to hear these stories and contemplate these stories. Norman, at one point in his career, some of us probably remember this, set out a task for himself. I'm not sure if I'm going to do this, but Norman at one point set out the task to give a talk on every one of the 100 cases. And he was in a position, you know, he was coming up here and I think still abbot maybe of Zen Center. So he had a lot of opportunities to give talks, several a month, so he got through it in only a couple of years. If I were to do it, it would take 4 or 5 years probably, but and still, it might be worthwhile, so who knows where we'll go, but we're on number one tonight. Might take a while. So one quality of these stories to mention up front, which is that these stories do emerge from a culture that shares some sexism with our culture. Maybe we're a little better about this because it would even occur to me to say this. It's probably a good sign. And so all these stories feature male teachers and students. Very, very infrequently are women mentioned. And there's research going on as we speak, maybe right now. Sue Moon and Florence are probably talking about their Women's Koans book. Maybe this very evening they're making phone calls or something. So research is being done into the women who were an important part of Zen history, Buddhist history, and some stories are emerging that we will learn about, and some books are already out. So we should know that that's the case. But I think it would be a mistake for us to be too... I'm worried about that point. I think we need to be aware of it and do what we can to find out about the important stories that are centered about women. But it would probably be a sort of a narrow... a narrow feeling to sort of be mad at our uncles here because they forgot about our aunts. They're still our uncles and our grandfathers and our fathers. So hopefully we'll find out little by little about the woman, but I just hope that we'll be open-minded and appreciate the Dharma insight of these stories of our male lineage ancestors. Not that there's anything wrong with being a little bit angry, or a lot bit angry about this, but to hold our anger in a productive way. Because who knows, you know, how many thousands and millions of women were repressed in this time, in 11th century China and all the ages before and after, and who knows how many men were oppressed. But anyway. So this particular book actually has two authors who are a century apart. So time is a little bit different in these kind of writings. Oftentimes in the middle of the story, it'll say, later, so-and-so asked so-and-so about this. Sometimes that's like 100 years later, you know, or a couple hundred years later. We read that and we think, oh, like, you know, an hour later, next day. You know. So the first, these 100 stories were initially collected in the early 11th century to make this book, by a Zen teacher named Shuedo. And then later in the 12th century, another Zen teacher author named Yuan Wu added commentaries and bundled it up and published with woodblocks, published a woodblock book in 1125. We actually know the date that it was published. And so in a given story in here, there are words from both of these masters as well as the traditional story. So the first case is the famous story of Bodhidharma. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Qi and asked him about it. Master Qi asked, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Master Qi said, "He is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, "Your Majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still wouldn't return." Okay, so Bodhidharma, according to tradition, was an Indian monk. And Buddhism already had been in China for a couple hundred years, probably. This is sometime probably in the late 5th or early 6th century, something like that. Or maybe a little earlier, I forget right now. And Bodhidharma is sort of like credited as being the one who sort of set the tone for Zen in China. And the idea is that he's fresh off the boat, presumably, and for some reason unexplained, has an audience with the emperor China. And the other part of the backstory is the emperor was a great patron of Buddhism. He had apparently support, you know, Buddhism. It was one of the periods when Buddhism had state support in China. Which, by the way, is a little bit funky when we make that Dana announcement and we say everything was freely given. Sometimes it's like you get, you know, you're getting a big salary from the emperor. Sometimes not, you know. Other times in China, the Buddhists were like strung up and persecuted, thrown out. So I guess you never know. Anyway, I'm just waiting for President Obama to start supporting Zen. It'll probably help, you know. Anyway, so for some reason he gets an audience with the emperor, who is himself a great patron of Buddhism, and maybe heard about this visiting monk from India. And India is the source country, right? So that would be exciting. Just like we'd be excited if a Japanese Zen teacher was in town, probably, you know. Even if, you know, we don't know anything about him, but ah, please come to our center and teach us. And asked him, well, what, you know, what is the meaning of all this? What's most important about Buddhism? And maybe there's a sense in this of what a request for like validation and support from this visiting holy person. And Bodhidharma doesn't give a discursive answer at all, doesn't explain anything, doesn't try to sort of help the emperor figure out how to practice or how to sort of refine the system. Bodhidharma doesn't ask for a salary himself, actually. He just brings up the emptiness side of our life. That so much of our suffering is this mind that divides, right? That wants to be good, that wants to know what's the most important thing. And they use the word holy here in the English translation, and I don't know, I wasn't able to find out what the Chinese character being translated was. You'll find out later. And holy, for us, has of course a lot of connotations from the Judeo-Christian tradition. So I looked it up in the dictionary. And for sure, one of the meanings of holy is being close to God or in service of God, something like that. But it turns out the word holy has actually an older root than that, that it's older than Christianity. And the word holy has a root not in specialness or closeness to God, but it's from Old English and Old Norse for wholeness and completeness. So holy is like whole. So that's another way we can look at this here. What is the meaning of the whole truth, the whole of the truth? And so we talked about emptiness a lot when we were studying the Heart Sutra. And here's just another way it's being brought up. There's no holiness. There's no right, and there's no no wrong. There's just this moment. And the emperor's a little surprised by this. And he asks Bodhidharma, who is facing me? Like, well, you know, who are you? What's your point of view? What's your attitude? What's your school of what's your philosophy? Is maybe what he means there. And here we have an interesting point. Usually when this story is read, Bodhidharma is made out to be very, very strong. Just sitting in his seat, unmoved by the sort of situation of being in the audience with the emperor of China. Just putting his foot down, right? Don't know. You know, I don't know. And often it's understood like Bodhidharma is like making a point or giving an emptiness teaching, like another level of emptiness teachings. Not only is there no holiness, but we don't know who we are. There's no me or you. You know, like with the emperor. But I was thinking about it for this talk, and I realized, well, We don't know that. Maybe it's actually a very humble response, a very real and alive response. Maybe Bodhidharma is a monk who's practicing diligently, trying to understand his mind and the patterns of how he gets caught in things and confused by things, the ways he forgets about emptiness. And when he's asked this question, who are you? He answers very honestly and very humbly, I don't know. I really don't know. I'd realize that any answer I were to give you wouldn't be quite right. I can't say I'm me or this or that or the other thing. And so it seems to me like the world is always asking us, who are you? Who is this facing me? And we're in Bodhidharma's seat to some extent every day. I don't know who I am or what I'm doing. But in any case, the emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma took off. And then there's a second, there's sort of two halves here. The second half is a conversation between the emperor and his advisor, Master Chi, or Chi, I'm not sure which. And the thing that's interesting in that account, which on the face of it seems to be, whoops, Mr. Emperor, you didn't notice, you had a really important teacher here, he's gone, you're not going to get him back. But an interesting part of that exchange is the way that Master Chi praises Bodhidharma. He says, he is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. And so we know that the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, so Kuan Yin here, is a Bodhisattva of compassion and keeps showing up in emptiness texts, which seem to be about wisdom and discernment. And here Bodhidharma has given this great famous emptiness teaching. All is empty, no holiness, I don't know who I am. And the praise for that teaching was that it was compassionate. So that's interesting. The praise was compassion. So wisdom and compassion are here in this story. So then Bodhidharma famously goes off to a cave, which eventually nearby is the famous Shaolin Monastery, where they invented Kung Fu later. Way later. And practice really diligently. So Bodhidharma is, in addition to our exemplar for bringing up emptiness in the face of the world calling you forth to pin something down, which is another way to look at that story, right? The world is calling for you to pin yourself down, to give your position, to say how it is. And so Bodhidharma is an example to us of the possibility of just openness, like, I don't know, which is sometimes called for, and how quickly we try to pin things down. So then he goes off to practice, and in his practice, he's an exemplar to us of diligence, a very strong diligence. So practicing all by himself, the story goes, he sat facing the wall for 9 years, not moving. One assumes he had to go to the bathroom and stuff, but you know, it's an example, you know, it's a myth, right? But it's a myth that we can bring forth that's helpful to us in our practice if we use it skillfully. There's a great possibility to us for compassion, for healing, for softening around our story just from sitting still, just from devotion to the practice of quiet, still sitting. And there's all kinds of stories, myths about this. It's such a central myth, so central myths spawn more myths. And one of the funny ones is, they're all a little gross too. They involve bodily mutilation to some extent. So one of the funny ones is that he was getting a little sleepy, so he rips off his eyelids and tosses them out of the cave, and where they fall, the first tea plants sprouted. So then the monks had tea to drink. Help them stay awake, yeah, even though they can't fall asleep now with their eyelids ripped off. So we don't really know if Bodhidharma actually existed. There's evidence that he did, but some of it's a little bit shaky. We certainly don't know if there was an Emperor Wu, that's historic fact. But we don't know if he met with an Indian monk named Bodhidharma. And in a way, that's a kind of a teaching of the story as well. We have a fairly narrow band around what's real and valid. So there's some encouragement here to receive some support from a somewhat bizarre, in ways, myth that's a root myth in a tradition that somehow, over thousands of years, brought us to this point. So there's something to it, some energy there. Another way that we can work with these cases, which I really recommend, it's worth doing, is to read them over several times and just feel into what feels like the pivot point of the story, the sort of key point in the story. And as these stories were further and further systematized, and training systems around them were systematized, especially starting in 16th century in Japan, there's an official key point in every story. But you don't need to worry about the official key point. You can just see what feels most important in the story. And oftentimes what people find about this particular story is this line, "don't know." It's written in the English translation as "I don't know" with the personal pronoun, which is implied, I'm sure, in the Chinese. But we could drop the personal pronoun, because who is it that doesn't know anyway? Just don't know. So this is one of the great things, I think, that Zen brings to modern discourse. The few nuts who practice it long enough to have some appreciation for it. This don't know, this not knowing. That not knowing could be a positive thing. It's kind of revolutionary, actually. Quite radical. Because we have a culture of knowing, right? Of expertise, of degrees, of all kinds, certificates. But there could be a great value, a great fluidity, a great freedom in embracing this not knowing, this don't know. And so it's actually possible to practice with this. So let's do a little experiment. So settle yourself in a little bit for a few moments of meditation, or whatever, stretch a minute, or whatever you need to do. You've been sitting there for a while. We know that Bodhidharma, from his text, practiced a lot with the breath. I don't really know exactly how. But let's take some inspiration from his example and just for spend a few minutes just really touching into the breath and the body. How the body actually feels at this moment. Noticing that there's breathing. Perhaps being interested in the feeling of the breath down low, the rising and falling of the abdomen. It's a very grounded place right in the center of the body. Feeling the felt sensation of the breathing in the abdomen as the Breath goes in and out. And letting the breath have all the space that it needs. You can count on the breath to do the breathing. And then as we exhale, try this experiment. On each exhale, just inwardly drop this phrase, "don't know," right into the belly, or let it flow right down through the belly with the exhalation. So inhalation giving some new energy and life, and then on the exhalation, "don't know." Just try that for a while. Like all our practices, if the mind gets distracted, even with like some commentary on this practice, just to bring it back to the intention. Breathing, don't know. Those words, just letting the mind return to quiet observation of the breathing. And being curious about whether bringing up that the don't know practice has generated some feeling of some kind, just to notice how things feel. Thank you for trying that. So it wouldn't be the worst thing to practice with that for a while if it caught your fancy. And if it didn't particularly, that's fine as well. But since Bodhidharma is also our inspiration for devoted Zazen practice, and is known to have worked with breath, I thought it wouldn't be the worst thing to mention a few ways that we often work with breath in Zazen. The first point about working with breath in Zazen is that it's not an idea. It's actually a felt experience. And it's interesting to sort of watch the mind. It's very easy for breath to become, the observation of breath become just kind of an idea. So just to be curious as you're studying breath always, is this really the felt sense of breathing in the body? To notice it. It seems sort of always the same. It might just be the sort of idea of breathing, sort of degree of separation. The mind is so good at generating sort of realities, right? So that's the first point about breath awareness, to be feeling the felt sense of breath in the body. The second point is that there are different ways of observing breathing. And the first we often recommend is counting the breath. And you may well know all this. I'm partly doing it for the recording, just to make sure everyone who practices, who listens to this stuff, will know these points, because it's important. And so the way that's done, and this turns out to be a very old practice. I was surprised to learn this. I thought breath counting was probably invented, you know, in the 1968, because the Americans were so squirrely or something like that. But it turns out to be a very old Chinese, written up in China in the era of these early koans. And so the breath practice is to be especially attentive to the exhalations and mark each one with a number internally, starting with one, inhalation, then two. And then should one get to 10, to return to one. Or sometimes they say five is enough, turns out. And if we don't get anywhere, to return to one. If we get somewhere else, to return to one. And so what's nice about this is it gives us a very clear marker of whether we're actually attending to what's happening right now. If we're not quite sure of the count, returning to one. And that the important thing, too, is that one of the great things about breath counting is it activates our sort of aggression and competitiveness with ourselves. That we want to get to 10, because they told us, go up to 10. Never in any breath counting instruction that you ever hear did anyone ever tell you, you should get to 10. You made that part up. It's interesting, huh? So it's not about getting to 10, it's about attending to the breathing that's happening now and having a clear kind of marker whether you are or not. And then working with these ancillary states of mind, like, oh, I should be, oh, I failed, only made it this far, not doing too well tonight. And it also helps us recognize that the state of mind is not like something we can sort of turn on and off with zazen. The state of mind is conditioned by what's happening in our life. And so the breath counting, instead of being a failure if there's a night when we can't get to two, it's just giving us information, like, oh, the mind is agitated. That's interesting. The mind, the sort of internal weather is stormy. And sometimes it's not even that obvious to us, you know, that we were agitated, you know. I'm like, oh, I guess there's agitation in the mind. Sometimes it's really obvious, right? Terrible things happened all day and, you know, no wonder. So that's one thing that's nice about breath counting. Another thing that's nice about breath counting is that return to one is a fairly clear and discreet inner action. We know when we're doing it. So that's nice too. And so we can work with the quality of return. How do we return to one? Many different ways to do that, right? Different levels of sort of gentleness or judgment or automatic, automaticity, is that the word? Automaticness or deliberateness. Consciousness or unconsciousness. So there's many different qualities of returning to one. And so that's kind of what's interesting about breath counting, is that returning the qualities of that and working with the qualities of that. And breath counting is also helpful if, even if we normally don't do it, sometimes we take it up if the mind is really scattered. There's a mysterious way that Zazen is helpful to us regardless of our subjective experience. So always to mention that when we talk to people about Zazen. It's not about having a nice subjective experience. It's nice, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a nice subjective experience. But it seems to be helpful in our life, done regularly, even if it's like a disaster zone in there every time. Most people find, though, if they take a step back and they look at the process of their life, the ways they're responding to our life, what's actually happening, well, you know, I've been making a big effort to sit zazen 30 minutes, you know, a day, and it always feels like I'm doing it wrong, but I'm way less, I feel like less reactive than usual or something, you know. Often they notice I feel sort sort of more in my skin somehow, less upset by something. So that's the usual first way of practicing with the breath in our school of Zen, the breath counting. And one is not in a hurry to sort of get past it onto something else. I practiced breath counting for at least 10 or 12 years. That's all I did. And then when I went to Tassajara, I told the teacher there, boy, my breath counting just feels very sort of rigid, non-automatic, and I feel like I'm trying to get good at it, and it's like, you know, can I please do something else now? And she said, oh, try counting backwards. So then for several more years, I started at 10 and went down and, you know, did so at Tassajara for however many thousand hours of meditation you do at Tassajara. So not to be in a hurry. There's no, we're not trying to accomplish anything. It's that returning. And you get a lot of opportunities no matter how you're practicing. But should breath counting seem just sort of too mechanical or too heavy or too sort of pulling you out of your experience in some way, if it sort of becomes about these numbers off to the side, like a, you know, like in the movies when they're doing these weird movie versions of computers, you know, those sort of numbers, then it's fine, of course, fine to drop it. And then the next way of practicing breath, usually suggested, is just following. And there's a couple of ways to follow the breath. Well, there's many ways. One is just to stay with that, emphasizing awareness of the exhalations, just feeling that exhalation, letting it go. You're aware of the inhalation, but the exhalation is just right where you're at. So that's one way. Another way is feeling the sweep of the breathing, inhalation, exhalation, very even. You could feel that just in the abdomen, or you could feel the breath moving through the whole body. And there's a real interesting possibility around making some choices here, being a little bit creative and deliberate in our practice, not just sort of a practice. I have a habit, you know, a practice habit, you know, zazen, here's my zazen habit, to make some choices as we sit down for this period or this month or this year. I'm going to try practicing this way, following the full sweep of breathing. And it's a great thing to talk to people about in practice discussion and doksan, of course. And then a third way of practicing is to allow your awareness of the breathing to have, this is a little bit hard to describe, to have your awareness of breathing have a feeling of sort of curiosity and interest to it. There's sort of a way of sort of turning up the light a little bit, making the breath a little more vivid. So it's sort of deliberately bringing forth a great sort of sense of really not knowing what breath is, right? Don't know. So just a liveliness. And you can do all these things in different combinations, right? A real lively sense of the exhalation in the belly, a lively sense of the full sweep of breathing. And then another way to work with the breathing is to bring a phrase into the breath, which we just tried, which is in a way using language, using concept. Every word, because of language, has a certain resonance and feeling to us, just dropping that in there. But it's also a way of holding and marking and exploring breath. And a phrase that they often recommend that you try first is to ask a question, because a question gives a real liveliness. So one of the most common questions is, what is it? Or what is this? You just breathe with that. What is it? What is it? But not to let the question become disembodied, to really breathe with that question, hold that question in the body. And so Bodhidharma went on to practice in his cave. He has only four disciples that we know about. Interestingly, one of them is a woman whose name, I don't remember if her name is known, I should find out. The first disciple, according to tradition, had to really prove how serious he was. Do you know this story? This is more gross than the eyelid story. So this is the story of the second Zen ancestor, Huainin, who Bodhidharma didn't think he was too serious, thought he was a little too in his head or something like that. And And he was outside, I guess the cave had a door by then. He was outside the door. And in the winter, asking for teachings. And Bodhidharma ignores him or something. I forget exactly how it goes. I didn't look it up for this talk. But he's insisting and insisting, and Bodhidharma's ignoring him, and it's snowing more and more, and he's like buried, like, you know, buried in the snow. You know, please take me. And then finally, for some reason, he had a sword. That part is really unclear. Why would this monk have a sword? And he uses the sword to chop off his arm. And then Bodhidharma opens the door. Oh, you're still here? Must have had a tourniquet with him, too, because he didn't bleed out. But, you know, and these are very masculine, aggressive-sounding myths. But to take from them something positive, to take from them devotion, to take from them love, to take from them a willingness to challenge ourselves a little bit. So if our Zazen practice is getting a little sleepy or a little habitual, a little groggy, a little to be willing to bring forth this spirit of like, this is a precious opportunity, you know? We have this evening of practice together in this place that we work so hard and pay all this money for. You know, to bring forth that spirit of Bodhidharma and just be like, okay, I'm really going to practice. I'm going to sit still. I'm going to really be with breath. And if I forget, I'm going to gently return. And of course, it's so easy for us to misunderstand these exemplars, these examples, and get all stiff and uptight, cause a lot of pain in our back and shoulders. Luckily, your back and shoulders will let you know. Or the opposite, right, to sort of rebel, goof off. So, you know, we hold it with some wisdom and with some compassion for ourselves. And we can feel into how these stories, these examples, are actually alive for us, for each of us. For each of us, it will be different than it is for me, and it was different for me last time I studied this story. It's always changing. Just like the dialogue we talked about a couple weeks ago about the stone bridge and the long bridge. How is that in our life? These many aspects of this story. The first aspect, the emperor wanting to be special, wanting to be holy in some way. Is there a part of us who is like Bodhidharma, who doesn't give a witty Dharma talk, and you know, you can imagine Bodhidharma could have said something really clever and been given like this big temple in the capital, right? And he probably, it probably occurred to him, you know, like, well, the emperor's really asking me this, you know. But somehow he brought forth this spirit of humility and not knowing. And so what is that for us? This, I don't know. I'm willing to sit here and admit that I don't know. Really feeling into that myself tonight. I really didn't want to give, for some reason I'm just not in a mood of giving a talk, and I felt like, oh, I'm not going to be very funny or interesting and they won't like me or something like that. And yet, I don't know, right? I don't know. Maybe these talk will be the most helpful thing, or someone in Peoria somewhere will listen to it on the web and it'll change their life. We don't know. So just bringing forth this tradition we've received as best we can. Because luckily for us, Bodhidharma appears in front of us whenever we need him, ready to guide us in his gruff and compassionate way, to lead us out of whatever blind alley we are in, trying to figure out our life, justify it, and all of that, so we can just say, thank you, Bodhidharma. All is empty. Nothing holy. Or we could say, all is empty, all is holy. Same thing. For some reason, all this made me think of a funny poem, so at least I have a little humor at the end. This is a poem called Bugs in a Bowl by David Bodbil. Hanshan, that great and crazy wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, "We're just like bugs in a bowl, all going around and never leaving their bowl." I say, that's right. Every day climbing up the steep sides, sliding back, over and over again, around and around, up and back down. We sit at the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself, or look around. See your fellow bugs. Walk around. Say, hey, how you doing? Say, nice bowl. Hanshan, that great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, "We're just bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl." I say that's right. Every day climbing up the steep side, sliding back, over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself, or look around. See your fellow bugs. Walk around. Say, hey, how you doing? Say, nice bowl. You have any thoughts on all this? I'd intended to do a little small... the small group processing thing, which is always good to do, but we don't have enough time, so we'll process together.
Who was the author? I just wanted to hear the poet's name again.
David Bodbil, Budbill. It's from a collection called Moment to Moment, Poems of a Mountain Recluse, Copper Canyon Press. David Bodbil. Sounds like Bug Bill. David Bud Bill. Bugs in a Bowl. So I'm also particularly interested these days because I feel fairly, you know, like unaware at times of these issues around these questions of gender dynamics and, you know, these male, this is like towards the masculine end of the spectrum, right? This story, you know, nothing holy, chopping off arms, ripping off eyelids. So how is that for you? Is it distracting, or you want to throw the whole thing out, or is it like, well, we can just use it for our best purposes to encourage us to awaken, and that's okay? What do you think about all that? Because all this was, of course, first introduced to us like, you know, but now we're trying to sort of feel our way into different angles on it all.
Well, there was, when we did the meditation of saying don't know on the exhale, I found that quite relaxing and felt my head saying, don't have to know.
Oh.
So,
that's interesting. That's interesting that a slight variation on the phrase popped into consciousness, and I always assume there's a certain wisdom to that, like, oh,
yeah.
Don't have to know is what I need to work with, like, okay.
Yeah,
that's nice.
And I've been kind of thinking about that sort of thing lately anyway, the impossibility kind of knowing anything.
Yeah. Makes me think of they made those two different books collecting the talks and sayings of Katagiri Roshi. You know, the first one was called Returning to Silence. The second one was called You Have to Say Something.
Yeah.
So it's like both, right?
Yeah.
It's both. Yeah.
And in a similar way to eating, I found saying I don't know kind of settled my thinking just stopped pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
My mind just kind of stopped scattering around.
Mm.
Relaxing, settling.
keep going, see what happens, you know. The other thing that's, and the other kind of balancing act too with, you know, like learning about these different practices and, you know, in a way, there's a great utility to, you just are assigned your practice and you just do it diligently without thinking about it, but in a way, that can be a little limiting. So some creativity, like I was saying, and sort of choosing, a little bit of picking and choosing is helpful, but on the other hand, you don't really learn much about any of these practices unless you really do them, like, you know, steadily for a long period of time. So, you know, there's kind of like, it's kind of a tricky thing, you know. I don't know if anyone, you know, talking to a teacher can help, but I think ultimately it's up to us, you know. What, you know, what's helpful to me right now? And it might be, yeah, just, I'm, you know, okay, there's some resonance now. Okay, I'm all about don't know for the next month, you know. Home practice, you know, Zazen practice, Kota Samish. Ah, a week of don't know, yes, you know. Even if I get bored with it and sick of it and want to do one of those other things, just, don't know. So, you know, on the other hand, that can be heavy and dull and, like, you should just lighten up and just breathe. I don't, you know, it's hard, really hard to say. Thoughts, or do you not know?
I was remembering watching G.I. Joe cartoon in middle school. And at the end of the cartoon, there'd always be this public service announcement where the kids learn something. Oh, now I know. And G.I. Joe says, and knowing is half the battle.
Knowing is half the battle? Yeah.
Maybe, you know, in the Zen version.
Not knowing is half the battle.
Not knowing is half the battle.
It's the other half.
It's great you have these teachings embedded in your consciousness. Yeah. Which is interesting too about how the mind works. I mean, like, that's one of the great values of It's one of the great values of doing anything repetitively, like watching G.I. Joe over and over and over again, or reading these cases over and over again, or practicing over and again. Somehow something just sort of is waiting for you, you know, like, the right teaching arrives at the moment. You know. G.I. Joe. Gee, I don't know, Joe.
For me, I usually don't like to count because it gets my discursive mind even more wound up in an idea. It occupies, gives my mind something to do while I'm trying to. But then what happens is I just move right off that into who knows what. And so I tend not to like to do that. That one wasn't quite so bad. I'm not, if I did it for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of ways of sort of.
Like the other ones do,
yeah. Well, there are lots of qualities in how you kind of hold those numbers too. Like, you know, sometimes we're just kind of like one, you know, and sometimes it really is this just very gentle, like whisper, like a whisper. Yeah. One, you know. Two. You know, it's just sort of like with the feeling of sort of the miracle of breathing in the number. Another breath. Yeah. But yeah, it can be that way.
I wander off and start saying, oh, I didn't get 3 gallons of gas, you know, I got 2 gallons. But it's just any excuse whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, that's just how it goes, you know. Yeah. That's all right. Just, you know, let the cow. Yeah. Well, sometimes you got to decide whether to, like, bolt the door or let the cow out of the barn, you know. And just let the cow wander around, and, you know, it's not a big problem. You got a cow, you know, whatever, you know. Nice grass. It's like the Bugs in the Bowl poem, right, you know? I just look around, and hey, nice bowl.
I was also thinking about Emperor Wu. He was told emptiness, you know. And then when you read it,
Yeah, that's a good way to read it, yeah. Yeah, right.
Which is another way of saying everything.
Yeah.
For all the possibilities.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, there's part of us who, we have this quality of sort of wanting to have some sort of peaceful experience in meditation or something like that, but sometimes emptiness is like upsetting and disconcerting, you know, and there's a sense of sort of losing identity, and it's like, ah, now what, you know? And then what you get back is don't know, you know? Yeah.
It changed. I went through don't know, and then I got this feeling of surrender, kind of like these guys are talking about. And then I got nervous about it and afraid of falling into confusion. And so it's kind of,
so
you know, the level underneath that feeling of surrender.
So there's fear and nervousness and confusion. Wow.
Yeah.
A sense of something underneath something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, like 3-minute meditation, something can happen. Yeah. And yeah, then for us there's kind of a discernment, like, okay, you know, does that mean I stay with this? Pull back a little bit? Hang on the edges of it and see what it is. Yeah. Hard to know.
Yeah, I'm just hung up with being resistant to the confusion.
Uh-huh. Not what you wanted. All right, maybe that's more than enough not knowing.